Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This show, I begin a summer series saluting women and men who helped shape the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
I have always thought that there's a tremendous art to science and a tremendous science to art. If you have this beautiful painting that actually is more interpretive, somebody looking at that exhibit can have access to the beauty and get more understanding of the importance of why we are worried about these things.
That's Aldona Janitis, who served as UA Museum of the North's director for over 20 years. She discusses art, culture, and the value of museums to improve society. And Chris Lott is in with another Cachexit Clippings.
The word bead came to describe not just the round threaded beads on the rosary, but any kind of small, vaguely spherical object, such as the sight on a gun, or to the beads of sweat that form on my forehead when I try to say or explain in sequence the words metonymy and synecdoche.
I hope you'll stick around. Every year about this time, UAF Summer Sessions puts on a wide range of free events for the public. There are concerts and talks, and by luck, I have the opportunity to play a small part in the programs by doing what I enjoy, talking with interesting people about their lives and passions. Every Monday night, in a series called Down Memory Lane, I speak with retired faculty who helped give shape to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This summer, I'm recording those conversations and presenting them in a special weekly series on Northern Soundings. Last week, I spoke with my first guest, Dr. Aldona Janitis. For most Fairbanks residents, she needs no introduction. As director of the University of Alaska Museum of the North, she brought vision, energy, and entrepreneurial skills to bear for over 20 years. She helmed a multi-million-dollar expansion of the museum and transformed the skyline of the university. And her annual chocolate fundraising events were the talk and envy of the community. Some may not know that Aldona is an art historian by training and practice, being an authority on the art of Pacific Northwest First Peoples. Before arriving in Fairbanks at the museum, she also served as vice president for public programs at the American Museum of Natural History. I began my conversation with Aldona by asking her whether she recalled the first time she was struck by beauty.
You know, no. Because I can't remember a time when I didn't think about beauty. Mm. You know, just nature, the trees, animals, art, and music. And I was listening to La Traviata last night on KUAC, and I said, I don't remember the first time I saw that or heard that, but that struck me as being one of the most beautiful things that I have ever heard in my life. And I was very young, so I don't know. It was just around me.
Now, a lot of parents like to see their kids go into law or medicine or engineering. And how did they take it when you said you were going to be an art historian?
A few things. Bear in mind my generation. I made a career decision many, many years ago when women were still choosing to stay at home. So women didn't necessarily have the pressures to have a good career that men did, not necessarily. But on the other hand, my father was an English scholar. My mother was an English teacher in high school and a poet. And so they just wanted me to be happy.
Yeah. Now, oftentimes in academic pursuits, there's an inspiring mentor or figure. Was there someone like that for you?
You know, there have been so many. I think the most important mentor that I ever had, because, you know, as you go through your career, you meet different people that you learn different things from. But the person that I learned the most from was a woman by the name of Gloria Cranmer Webster. And she's a Kwakwaka'wakw, which is, you might know the name Kwakiutl that Franz Boas wrote about and spent a lot of time, the father of American anthropology. And I was at the American Museum of Natural History, which has an amazing collection of Kwakwaka'wakw material. And so I said, I'd like, you know, I asked the people at the museum, is it okay if I do an exhibit on the Kwakwaka'wakw potlatch, which is their main ceremony of giving gifts and displaying their mass and lots of feasting. And this was by no means the rule at that time, as it is now. It was clear that it couldn't just be me being the authority. That's not acceptable anymore. And certainly at that point, it was beginning not to be acceptable. This was in the very early 90s. And so I went to Alert Bay, which is the main town. It's on the coast of Vancouver Island. And I met the director of the Native-run museum there. Her name was Gloria Cranmer Webster. And she and I collaborated on Chiefly Feast, the name of this exhibit. You know, I learned so much from her. I mean, I'd started studying Northwest Coast art out of museums. I had gone to the American Museum of Natural History since I was very little. And I went to lots of museums and went to lots of archives. And you look at these objects in storage cabinets, and they're for me, they were extraordinary. And then you learn about what they were used for, and that was amazing. But I was trained at Columbia that in something called salvage anthropology. What that is that you find out what a culture was like before it was acculturated, before the culture was polluted. I'm using these words in by Western influence. There was a pure culture, and then there was a polluted culture. And so in salvage anthropology, you try to find out by studying the archives and the objects, what the authentic culture was like before acculturation. And so anything else, and I was kind of trained this way at Columbia, which was in the 70s, so that's a long time.
Was that unusual to be trained that way?
No, this was pretty much what all people who were doing what was then called primitive art or ethnographic art were trained in. You had to find out, you were expected to find out what the material was really all about in the time that this was a pristine primitive society. And anything that was happening now was degraded or not really, it was certainly not authentic. Well, anyway, I went to Alert Bay and I met Gloria. I mean, I was prepared for this too. And first of all, she taught me about authority, who's got the right to talk about certain things. And then she also said that, you know, our culture never died. We're as authentic now as we were in the 19th century. We're just different. She said, if you're going to do an exhibit on the potlatch, you have to go to a potlatch. And so she invited me to this potlatch, which was, they have these big houses where they have carved. These are the natives that make totem poles. And there was masked dancing and lots of singing and tremendous food. And it was so clear to me, there was no such thing as pre-contact and post-contact, or pure culture and acculturated culture, that culture is a continuum, and that what's happening now is just as important, if not more important, because it communicates the survival of the culture. And so she taught me that. And she also taught me that you have to listen to contemporary Native people. I mean, books are important, and it valued scholarship, but she said, what we can teach you. So I learned an enormous amount from her and from a lot of the other people I worked with on that exhibit.
I want to come back to that, but a couple of things you mentioned I want to unpack. For example, when you started your career, you used the term primitive art. That's what it was called back then.
Yep.
Was it a serious discipline in art history, or were you taking a chance or going out on a limb by focusing that is your discipline interest?
Okay, I started graduate school in 1970, okay? And this was the time, I'm gonna answer your question.
Yeah, I figured.
This was a time of the civil rights movement, which I was strongly behind, and the anti-war movement, which I was involved in. And just this notion of the recognition that oppressed people were oppressed, and something had to be done about this. So I was an art historian. I chose to be an art historian in college because it struck me. I'd always drawn and painted when I was a kid, and then I discovered that you could learn about art, which I loved. So that was a fabulous major. I mean, I just, sitting looking at beautiful paintings and writing about them, how much more can you enjoy life than doing that in college? Right. And I had a wonderful medieval professor, so I said, oh, I'm going to go into medieval art. And then I discovered that that was really not me. And then when I went to Columbia, art history tends to be a fairly elitist discipline. You have people who are go into Renaissance or Baroque or medieval, and it's all Western culture. And so I said, what am I going to specialize in? Then it just so happened that there was this professor, Douglas Fraser, who was teaching a night course on oceanic art. And I said, oh, that sounds interesting. I was sitting in the course, and all of a sudden I said, he's talking about an indigenous art of an indigenous population that makes incredible art that nobody recognizes as art. It's anthropology, and most people don't even know about it. And if they know about it, then maybe they will become less oppressed. It's a very sort of idealistic notion. So I said, I walked into his office the next day and said, I'm going to become a primitivist. I was serious. I said, this is what I want to do. I found what I want to do. And actually, some other colleagues of mine who are of my generation had the same ethical decision that this is what we wanted to do to promote the culture. Now that's also a very colonialist notion. I mean, I recognize that it's a very colonialist notion. And I have certainly changed my attitude. I'm talking about, you know, many years ago. And in those days, it was called primitive art because, you know, they thought it was art from the past or people who were primitive cultures, i.e. lower than industrialized cultures. There's a whole racist notion to the term primitive. And then in terms of the acceptability of this subject at universities, there were very, very few places that taught primitive art, that was then called primitive art. There were, you know, maybe 6-7 universities in the country. And Columbia, my mentor and his mentor were always not very enthusiastically accepted.
Has it changed at all? I mean, it's certainly...
It's changed enormously, but there are still some people who look down on it.
Right, right. The other point, two points that you made earlier on and kind of alluded to, is there's this whole notion, too, that many of these artifacts were brought over from the culture that produced them so that they're housed in this institution. And then secondly, your mentor that you mentioned was a woman, and A, you were talking about women weren't necessarily going into these professions, and B, they weren't really studied as major contributors to the artifacts, right? Is that right?
Well, you're talking about women artists.
Artists.
Oh, yeah. Anthropology was by and large a male discipline for a long time. I mean, Franz Boas, who was my hero, I never met him, but he was my hero and he still is, did train a lot of women like Ruth Benedict and some other important women. But what was interesting is that in Native America, there is a distinction between art made by men and art made by women. And art made by men tends to be figurative. This is throughout all of Native America. It's actually true in a lot of different ethnographic cultures, or spirits, or things that we can see as very meaningful. So men would paint battle scenes in the plains. In the Northwest Coast, they would carve the totem poles. They would make the masks that represented some kind of spirit being or being that in some time in the past interacted with some ancestor to make that ancestor get this privilege of being able to show that mask. And men's art was something that people, anthropologists, found really interesting because, oh, here's a mask, we want a mask dance, you can study the mask dance, you can study the mask, really interesting, and we'll collect it. Women, on the other hand, made things that tended to be more abstract. Men did painting and sculpture. Women did textiles, baskets, ceramics, and leatherwork, beadwork, quillwork. And so immediately what one might designate is that what men do is art. What these women do is craft. Hmm. And there's a hierarchy, of course, because, you know, art is higher than craft. And then if you look at the crafts that these women did, they very rarely had images of spirits or things that were easily readable. Most of these objects by women had geometric designs, mm-hmm. or floral designs, or very abstract, and you couldn't actually read them. There was no apparent
narrative or story.
No narrative. And so men's art had meaning and women's art didn't have meaning. It was purely decorative. And so very little attention was paid to women's art until very recently. And the reason is that if you talk to the women, you discover that the art that they make is incredibly meaningful. It's just a different kind of meaning. Mm. I'm working right now on a weaver, a woman who weaves, and you have to, if you're, let's say this, the Tlingit weaver, you have to collect the material, like spruce roots for baskets. You can only pick the spruce roots out of the sand at a particular time of year. You have to know that this is the time of year that you can harvest the spruce roots. Then, if you're going to make dyes, we're talking about making a basket right now, you have plant dyes, and you have to know exactly when this yellow plant blooms, so you can take that. You have to know when that orange plant flower blooms, so you can make that into a dye. Then, if you're doing like a textile, you have to know when the right time to collect the mountain goat wool is. You can't just collect it all year round. So the woman has to know the cycle of nature incredibly intimately in order to be able to make her art. And the art then that she makes embodies this cycle of nature. Men's art is about, you know, about right now, it's about interactions, it's about politics, it's about, you know, spirituality, but religion, of course, for those, some of us think the religion is the handmaiden of the society,
right?
No matter what kind of religion it is. So the women's art is much more subtle. We're talking about the understanding, the scientific understanding of the world around you. And this is true of all these different kinds of women's art throughout Native America. And the other thing, and I've actually spoken to some weavers about this, is we have in the museum several Tlingit blankets. We have two Chilkat blankets and then one raven's tail blanket, which is a more geometric blanket. And it takes much more than a year to weave one of those things. And the detail and the fineness that you have to do to make these perfect, and the concentration and the aesthetic knowledge and figuring out where everything is going to go, it's much harder than just taking an adze and chopping some wood. I respect men's artists. I wrote a book about totem poles.
I'm getting exhausted just hearing how they put it together.
Yes. And then at the end, when you take the blanket off there's a ceremony of taking the blanket off. It's like you are giving birth to this. Mm. It takes so long. It's like you are nursing this child within you. And so the woman's art is also a manifestation of womanhood, procreation. And so now women's art is, hey, this is really interesting. This is really important. And so you are getting much more attention being paid to Native American women's art. And what's really interesting is that the museum, this was in the front page of the New York Times the other day, the Minneapolis Institute of Art just opened the first ever exhibit of Native American women's art. And it was curated completely by women. All of the people in the catalog are women. All the show, all the material is by women, and it's apparently a fabulous show. So women's Native women's art has kind of made a major step by getting exhibited in a truly major important art museum.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with art historian and former director of the University of Alaska Museum of the North, Aldona Janitis. When we return from the break, we'll hear about the repatriation of First Peoples artifacts. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with former UA Museum of the North director Aldona Janitis. I asked her if the growing respect for and collaboration with Indigenous cultures in museum exhibits and collections were difficult for some institutions. Let's hear her response.
Yes. Actually, my favorite story about that was, you've probably heard of the Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act. Now I'm beginning to go a little bit into the museums as well as into scholarship. NAGPRA, it was passed in 1990, and it's the Repatriation Act that museums have to return certain kinds of human remains, absolutely, and return certain kinds of objects to the communities that they hold. And when this was being discussed in Congress, I was at the American Museum of Natural History. They were so upset. There, those Indians are gonna take all of our stuff. We're gonna lose everything. And the physical anthropologists who, you know, those are where the skeletons, I mean, the stories of how the museums got these human remains utterly appalling. And they were saying, you know, we can't do this. And so they were like, the big natural history museums in the States hired lobbyists. And I was sitting there saying, wait a minute, this is a good thing. Because, I mean, I'd already begun working with Duke Laurier, and I've already begun to change my attitudes about Native authority. And the people of the Museum of Natural History, I think they didn't like the fact that I was supportive of this.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, you know, that attitude is one of the reasons I came here, because some museums took a long time to recognize the ethical standards of what a museum needs to do in order to do the right thing. And when I came here for my job interview, this museum had been doing that for years.
Mm. Well, that's a perfect transition about coming up here. Obviously, being closer to the Northwest, cultures you've studied must have been an allure. But what was in the back of your mind? You're from the premier institution in the country or the world. So what were your thoughts when you took up coming to Fairbanks?
My friends all thought I had a nervous breakdown. My New York City friends thought I had a nervous breakdown. First of all, I wrote my dissertation on the Tlingit. So I had been, you know, I came to Alaska when I was doing research in the early 70s, and I remember going to Glacier Bay and sitting and saying, this is my spot. And I said, Alaska's really someplace special. And I'd always been an outdoorsy person, and I'd always wanted to get out and do interesting, like, outdoorsy things. But, I mean, it was also a very intellectual decision. I mean, I said I didn't fit in at the American Museum of Natural History. It's a fabulous place. It's an extraordinary institution. And now it's completely changed. Mm. They are redoing their Northwest Coast Hall, and they have a whole team of Indigenous consultants who are working closely with the curators there to create a whole new exhibit of their amazing Northwest Coast collection. They have changed. They are very positive about repatriation. But this was many years ago. And I said, I just don't fit in here. Mm. And I wanted to be in a place where I actually fit in. Then I came to Fairbanks for an interview, more on a lark to get a lot of miles on United Airlines.
Okay, you heard it here first.
I mean, you know, I was also very interested because I'd never been to Fairbanks. I'd been to Anchorage and Juneau and all the Southeast places. And I have to say, I stepped off the plane and said, my God, it was February. Gorgeous. It was 20 above and sun. And I said, this is beautiful. Then I went into the museum and I walked around it and I said, this is the best museum of its size and mission I have ever seen. This size, a university museum, I mean, there are so many different kinds of museums. You can't just say museums,
right.
This is what a museum is. You have lots of different kinds of museums. And I love the fact that they name the artist of, you know, the native artist of objects like baskets and things, when they knew what the name was. I was very impressed by the way the material was laid out, not in a disciplinary fashion, but an interdisciplinary fashion. Mm. I also was walking through, and I used to teach Native American art when I was at Stony Brook, and I always started with this beautiful little ivory carving, about this big, and it was a woman with a little critter on her stomach, and it was called the Akvik Madonna. And I always started my classes with this 2,000-year-old ivory to show this is one of the, there's a lot of older material, but this is an iconic first example of great art that Native Americans made. But I was walking through the gallery, and all of a sudden, I was completely blown away because there was the Akvik Madonna. I could be in a museum with the Akvik Madonna, which is my favorite object of all times. Then I remember I went to a brunch at Lenny Kamerling's house, and it's in a birch forest, and it was sunny, and the sunlight streaming through, and the quality of a winter sun. I just said, this is beautiful. Mm. Talk about beauty from, you know, I want to be surrounded by beauty. Then I met the people. The other thing is that the people that I met were like the people I'd gone to college with, the radicals that I'd gone to college with. But they didn't turn into three-piece suitors as the people in New York had. They stayed that way. Uh-huh. They stayed positive. They stayed progressive. They stayed very, very committed to the kinds of things I was committed to. And I said, this is where I really want to spend the rest of my life. Mm. This is the place for me. And I never looked back. I made my decision within a couple hours of getting here. And Paul Reichart was the person, the hire, and I said, I really want this job. So it was.
Well, it worked out. But let me ask you, within a relatively short time, you took on administrative responsibilities. Not everybody who's a scholar or an art historian likes that kind of work, but somehow you seem to thrive in that. When did you realize you had a gift for it and that it was something you wanted to focus on?
Well, first of all, let me answer that I think tenure, this is another answer to your, this really is an answer to your question. Tenure is something very, very important. And I think that when a university gives somebody tenure, it is their obligation with that privilege to keep on pursuing knowledge. We are given tenure so that we can have the freedom to learn and write and study and do research with new things. So I have always thought that if I decided to go the scholarly route, which is the first thing that I wanted to do, it was my obligation to continue to produce scholarship. Then, of course, it was Native American material, and I mean, I have changed my attitude tremendously from that, you know, very romantic and colonialist notion to a very much different way of looking at things and collaborative and giving up authority to Native people and so on. So that's kind of one of the things that I said, this is what I am. I really am a scholar. The problem is that when I was at Stony Brook, I became, you know, the department chair then I became various other administrative jobs, and I was good at it. You know, when you see a problem and nobody else
steps up,
either wants to,
all right,
or has the ability to, or can solve it. Well, I just went in there and I could solve it. So that's why I became an administrator.
Now, our museum, as you've pointed out, is both a research museum and houses an amazing collection of fine art. Mm-hmm. So it has this dual purpose. Tell me about how to balance those two interests so that both feel they're understood and pursue their passions.
Well, that's a really hard question because, you know, the distinction between art and science, that is what some people feel. A scientific perspective and an artistic perspective are very different, and how can you make the twain meet? I have always thought that there's a tremendous art to science and a tremendous science to art. And so the differences are just very superficial. And you can use art to get a greater knowledge of some information. For example, if you're doing an exhibit on salmon, you want the exhibit to talk about what the salmon is, and that it's a fish that lives in the ocean and spawns in fresh water, and you need to worry about, you know, the climate change and all that. And so you're doing an exhibit on this, a lot of scientific information. Well, if you have this beautiful painting of a salmon that actually is more interpretive and has expressions of life and vitality and connection with the natural world, somebody looking at that exhibit can have access to the beauty and get more understanding of the importance of why we are worried about these things, and that the scientist can look at the artwork and say, oh, there's a lot more there than just the chemicals and the graphs. Mm. And then the art person can say, oh, I learned all this about how it, you know, how it spawns and what it does in the ocean and what it eats and so on and so forth. And so, and that's just one example.
Yeah, they're complementary.
They complement each other very, very well. Mm-hmm.
But most of the collection, especially in a research, lies in the vault. So when you went about to transform and expand the museum, that must have been a deep consideration, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes, but.
But.
We are not only an exhibit museum. And actually, that's a very small part of our mission. It's very important to have exhibits because that's basically how the museum makes its income, mm-hmm, from the tourists who come and come to the front door and see the exhibits, which are fabulous. We're a university museum, and that makes us very different from a lot of other museums in the state and around the country. Because what our mission is to collect and research the natural, cultural, and art history of Alaska. And that's why we have only like 5% of our collections on exhibit, because the other 95% is in the basement, open to scholars, open to scientists, open to indigenous people. We welcome people whose culture we have in our, and we feel that they are the real owners of this material and they have tremendous access to it. And so, yes, there are complaints about only 5%. But you know, if you go to the Gallery of Alaska, which is incredibly old, I mean, it's ancient. It's from 1980. And we've been trying to raise money to change it.
I know.
And this is not the time to raise money. It's really not. Can you imagine more stuff in there? More stuff from the basement?
No. Well, that bifurcates my next question in a funny way. So I'm going to tackle that issue. Of course, I'm of an age, mm-hmm, where I remember exhibits were pinned to a page, let's say a moth, and there was a little card there that right. told you the mm-hmm. scientific name and something. But today, electronic media has transformed how you reach the public or how you even reach your peers. Like, you can have your collection digitized. So tell me about that transformation as a director of a research museum.
Well, first of all, the opportunities for research with, we have an amazing database of our collections, and it's both the natural history and the cultural history. And this database can be used all over the country by scholars and scientists, and you know, photographs of objects and a huge amount of information. And so many people don't even have to, used to have to come here to do research, mm-hmm. and sometimes they still do for a variety of different things.
For the airline miles.
So that kind of digitization of the collections is fabulous. And then in exhibits, you can have videos that show objects in use or other kinds of interactives. But the one thing that distinguishes a museum like ours from a huge number of different learning institutions is that we have the real thing. And no digital reproduction can sort of
inspire or move or...
You walk in, you see something, and there's like an aura, the aura of reality, the aura of this is the real thing. When I used to take people on my 10-minute speed tour around the museum, you know, when you had some people that needed to just see it, I would always stop at Blue Babe, which is a 36,000-year-old mummified steppe bison killed by an American lion. And I said, that is 36,000 years old. And a model would not have the same impact with the person. That's a real thing.
I interviewed Roland Gangloff, and I remember he took me down and he handed me a Tyrannosaurus Rex 2.
Yeah.
And I was like, You're holding it. Was like, oh, I'm holding this, you know, and it's exactly. so old and it's a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the thing that I think is still the heart and the soul of any museum. Mm. Museums are trying very hard to get with the program with young people who spend mm-hmm. all their time in their cell phones, and older people who spend a lot of time in the cell phones.
I'm just trying to read it. I can't, you know, can't see. What is it?
You know, it is a challenge for museums. It really is. But I think there's a good balance between the positive nature of what we can get from computers and media, and then the real thing that irreplaceable, absolutely irreplaceable.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm airing a public conversation I had last week with former UA Museum of the North director Aldona Janitis. It's part of a UAF summer session series called Down Memory Lane. When we return from the break, transforming the UAF skyline. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded conversations I host as part of a UAF summer session series called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with former UA Museum of the North director Aldona Janitis. She successfully spearheaded the museum's expansion and received no small amount of grief for the addition's bold design, as you'll hear.
Well, you said now is not a great time to fundraise. Some would say a multi-million dollar, 40 million or something expansion. There's no good time to do that. But you managed to help to. So tell me about that process. And the design is so unique.
Yeah.
For all, I think a lot of people who grew up, the columns and lintels of traditional museums,
right.
That was a bold move. So tell me about that process.
Well, first of all, I mean, I just came from New York City, where the American Museum of Natural History could raise $50 million in 3 months from its board of trustees. So when I got here, and I said, oh, yeah, sure, what's the big deal? I was in Alaska.
Yeah, I wasn't
in New York anymore. But the point is that if you really have a project that you believe in, things are possible. It took a lot longer. Couldn't have done it without Grace Scheibel and Joe Usabelli and a lot of volunteers, and the museum staff helped. I mean, it was a real team effort, and it worked beautifully, and there were such positive things. And about the design, I said to the people who were out, you know, looking at the potential, who wanted the job, I want the building to communicate Alaska somehow. That's an artistic challenge. And Joan Serrano began just making a design that looked like many different things in Alaska. Glacial ridges, breakup on the Yukon, diving whales, a mountain ridge, lots of different things, and it just fit beautifully.
It's so funny, I can't imagine now the museum any other way. But for a lot of people, I think it was a hurdle. It's like modern art, you know.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes you think, what are you thinking? But now I can't imagine it any other way.
A lot of people hated it.
Yeah.
You know, it's you get used to things after a while. And I think people got used to it. And now it's almost 15 years old. So it's
remarkable.
Not, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, maybe look in your crystal ball. And where are museums going? What are the big challenges for both this particular one or institutions like museums?
The real challenge for all museums is maintaining the funding for National Science Foundation, NOAA, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts. These are all organizations that fund, among many other very important things, museums. And so that's important. That's incredibly important. And I guess I'm very optimistic about the future. I mean, right now it's difficult, but things always change. Things always get better. And I think that museums, there was a survey done, maybe 10 years ago, and the result was that people trust the information they get in museums far more than the information they get in a lot of different places. Of course, newspapers are way down at the bottom. But museums, people believe in museums. And as we progress into the future, where there are problems in the future that need to be addressed, cultural understanding is still something that I was hoping that we would not have to worry about that, you know, after the 70s. You know, but it still is the case.
It's still here, yeah.
And then global warming and pollution of the oceans and a lot of other things that are important issues that museums have the ability and the responsibility to create exhibits that provide the information that will help people be able to make good decisions about where they think the world should go. And that kind of is, I think, the future of museums. And the collections that we have are amazing, because let's say that the botanical collection, we have plants that were collected, you know, 50 years ago from a particular area. Then we have plants collected from that exact same area last year. And the changes are so dramatic. You cannot deny that. That's the kind of thing that a museum with its collections can really communicate to the public. And we have the mission to do that. And I think we will continue to be important. And the other thing is, people always love to look at pretty things. And art museums will always continue to be very much appreciated by lots of people.
Well, okay. So not only did you retire once, but you retired twice because you came back for a stint. I won't go into that, but one of the amazing facts about your retirement is that you and Ken built a house that's off the grid. That's kind of daunting, I would guess. Tell me a little bit about that.
This is actually, if I can just do a little bit of autobiography. When people in New York thought I was crazy, then I came here and everyone thought I would leave after 5 years when I was vested. Then everyone thought I would leave when I retired. And now, obviously, I'm here and I'm not going anywhere. Ken is a dog musher, as you know, and he has lots of dogs. We have a total of 24 dogs in our house. Some of them are mine. I'm a horsewoman and I have goats. Where we used to live, his place wasn't good for horses, and my place wasn't good for lots of dogs. So we began looking for a place, and we found 20 acres off the grid on a hill with the whole Alaska Range, Denali, and then to the north, the Whites. And we said, that's where we're going to live. And bless his heart, my husband is a scientist and can do anything. And he is the one who designed the solar panels and the wind turbine and has the batteries. I'm in charge of the beauty. He's in charge of making it function.
Well, there's a complementarity between art and science there, right?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, right, you talked about the animals. That's a challenge. I mean, you know, how many horses do you have?
Just two.
Just two, uh-huh. And any other critters?
Yeah, we have four goats, and yesterday we had eight kids. Today we have seven kids, because one is in the freezer.
Ah.
And the problem is, I don't know whether you noticed, but I injured my quadricep tendon and I can't move. And so the problem is that I'm incapable of doing anything.
Mm.
So my wonderful husband, in addition to being able to do anything and fix anything,
is doing it now.
Is doing everything and is taking care of all the animals and has even had to do the garden. And but that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But it's heavenly, because my grandfather, my grandparents were immigrants from Lithuania. All of them came from Lithuania at the turn of the century, and they were all from farms. And my grandmother would often tell me about in the winter, when the baby lambs were born, they had to bring the baby lamb into the kitchen, which had a dirt floor. And I thought those stories were wonderful. My grandfather trained jumping horses in the Russian cavalry. And I've always had the soul of a farmer. And so now, I can't tell you, it is the best life.
Mm. It sounds magical.
That I can imagine. And it's really incredible that, you know, I have Fairbanks. I got my friends, whom I adore. I got my great husband. I've always been a horse crazy person. And now I have horses, which is a childhood dream that's still fantastic. I worked at a museum that is so wonderful, with the most incredible staff.
Mm.
I mean, my life has been really, really good. And I've written books about something that I really care passionately about.
So we all win. It's a win-win.
Right.
Well, Donna Giannatis, I want to offer a few moments that we have left for this hour to the audience to ask any questions they may have.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to repeat that question so everybody can hear it. She observed that you were a remarkable administrator, especially when financial times were tough, and you were collaborative with your staff to find solutions.
Yeah, and we didn't have to fire anyone.
You reduced your own salary.
Yeah.
But
that was okay. That means I could spend more time at my farm.
With the horses. Again, a win-win, huh?
You got it. Thank you.
Yeah. I saw a question over here. The question is what's the connection between folk art and so-called primitive art?
There's a lot of different ways to answer that question, but let me give you my own personal thing, because I am, in my soul, an egalitarian, and I think that anything of the same category is equal. Visual art is equal. Painting, sculpture, masks, some sort of, like, you know, something that would be called folk art. They're equal, but the terminology that has been created by Western scholarship puts them in different hierarchical categories. And so folk art is made basically by people who are usually not particularly educated. Therefore, they're lower than people who are educated. Oh, the term primitive, which is never used anymore, was the term that was used when I was in graduate school for the art of Native America, Africa, and the Pacific, the indigenous world. That's what primitive was.
Any other questions? He has intimate knowledge of Machu Picchu, and he's asking, how do you stop taking the cultural artifacts, selling them to museums, private museums?
Actually, it's often to rich people. That continues to be a horrible problem throughout the world, wherever you have archaeological material. Sometimes you have a culture, a society where people are very poor, and if they can take something and sell it, they'll make much more money than they would if they just did their normal subsistence. And so the answer to your question is that we have to enhance the economic stability of those countries so that it's not necessary anymore for people to have to sell these things. If the people are not these poor people, but you know, other just crooks, it's important that you make the laws stronger about how to deal with these. And the country should get to be more sensitive to what's going on there. But it really requires a major cultural change. And then another possibility is to, and this is why it's so weird about Machu Picchu, because a lot of people have had their consciousness transformed by making something that used to be something that they could loot into a tourist attraction. And they realize, oh, this whole Mayan site is very important, and therefore people will come and pay money if it's all there. And if it's not all there, they won't pay the money. They won't come. How do you deal with greed? I mean, I hate to end on a sad note, but yeah, you're not going to be able to persuade those people to stop. Right now, culture change is the only way to go, I think.
Well, I want to take this opportunity to thank Aldona Janaitis for joining us and talking about a rich life and experience here. Thank you.
Well, actually, thank you. It's been an honor. I have admired your wonderful skills at interviewing for years and years and years. And
thank you.
Links to UAF summer sessions and the UA Museum of the North are on the Northern Soundings website. My thanks to Michelle Bartlett and Summer Sessions for permission to air the discussions. When we return from the break, Chris Lott takes a bead on language with another edition of Cachexic Clippings. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. It's time for Chris Lott and Cachexic Clippings.
A few weeks ago, while hunting for forgotten treasures on and between the pages of books at a thrift store, I found myself flipping through an old daily devotional. One of the bits of beautifully handwritten marginalia read, "Give us this day our daily bead." This slip of the pen, or lapsus calami if you're feeling insufferable and tweety, turned out to have its own kind of truth. The word bead comes to us from the Old English jebed, prayer, which in turn evolved from the Proto-Indo-European root beda, to ask or pray, which likely comes from an even earlier root meaning to urge or press. Bead came to have its common modern meaning of a small ornament thanks to the practice of using rosary beads, beads threaded on a string, to count prayers, a practice described with phrases like counting one's beads or telling one's beads. If, like me, you grew up far away from Catholicism, you've surely seen rosaries elsewhere. Perhaps in Shakespeare, as when Richard II declares, "I'll give my jewels for a set of beads." In other words, he would trade valuable gems for a rosary. Or if your diet was less heady, rosaries abound in movies and television, though I'm still waiting to find another person who first learned what a rosary was thanks to that great spirit guide Billy Joel, who sang to the luckless, arguably late Virginia, "You didn't count on me when you were counting on your rosary." Eventually the word bead came to mean not just the prayers being counted, but the beads themselves. In this way, bead is a figure of speech known as metonymy, or referencing one thing or concept using the name of something closely associated with it. For example, we might talk about our native tongue to refer to our first language, or our car as our wheels. Though technically, calling a car a set of wheels is a specific form of metonymy called synecdoche, using a part of something to refer to the whole, or vice versa. A classic example of synecdoche is all hands on deck, where presumably the captain expects more than just disembodied hands to appear at his command. Meanings tend to expand over a word's lifetime. The word bead came to describe not just the round threaded beads on the rosary, but any kind of small, vaguely spherical object, such as the sight on a gun, the source of phrases such as to draw a bead on something, or beads in mid-20th century crime fiction referring to morphine tablets, or to the beads of sweat that form on my forehead when I try to say or explain in sequence the words metonymy and synecdoche. The rosary part of those rosary beads is also notable. Plants and gardening have long been metaphors for spiritual and artistic practices. Note I'm sparing you an attempt to elaborate on the difference between metaphor and metonymy here. The word rosary comes from the Latin rosarium, which referred to a collection or a garland of roses. Like the word anthology, originally used to refer to the act of flower gathering that came to be used as a word for a collection of poetry and then writing of all kinds, rosary was taken up as the name for a series of prayers, specifically paternosters and Ave Marias, and then generalized to the string of beads used as a memory device to keep track of them. Roses, the Greek goddess Aphrodite's flower, have been a potent symbol for so long, of youth, beauty, Cupid's bribe, vitality, virginity, secrecy, and so on, that they've arguably come through the other side of symbolism to meaninglessness. Umberto Eco, in the postscript to his novel The Name of the Rose, a book-length exploration into semiotics, signs, and symbols in the shape of a 14th century Sherlockian Franciscan friar's adventures, wrote that he chose the title because the rose is a symbolic figure so rich in meanings that by now it hardly has any meaning left. If that's you, you might perhaps take heart in H.L. Mencken's famous quip that an idealist is one who, on noticing that a rose smells better than a cabbage, concludes that it makes a better soup. So it stands to reason that many words and phrases derive from the rose. Of the many not yet archaic words and phrases related to it, rosacea, rosette, and the rosy-billed pochard among them, subrosa deserves its own note. A Latin phrase that has been carried unchanged into English to communicate sub rosa is to do so in confidence, or literally, under the rose. In fact, Roman banquet rooms often had roses painted on them as a reminder to those gathered there that what happened in the Roman banquet hall stayed in the Roman banquet hall. As one of those Latin holdovers that lends a bit of sophistication where it appears, sub rosa appears in deep, heady works. As a fossilized phrase, it shows up in writing of all kinds, low and high, formal and informal. But an appearance that has stuck with me, both because I read it at a particularly formative time in my growing attention to language, and because the experience described was one still very fresh in my mind, is found in David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, where he writes vividly of particularly painful athletic drills, such as the kind we called in high school suicides. Wallace writes, "Puker drills are really meant to do nothing but hurt you and make you think long and hard before repeating whatever you did to merit them. But they're still, to all outward appearances, exempt from any kind of Eighth Amendment protest or sniveling calls home to parents insidiously, since they can be described to parents and police alike as just drills assigned for your overall cardiovascular benefit, with all the actual sadism completely sub rosa." For a bit more babbling about these linguistic baubles, definitely not sub rosa, draw a bead on cotexic.com/KUAC with your favorite browser.
That's it for this Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next week when I talk with scientist Dr. Joan Braddock. Thanks for listening.